Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 5, delivered on September 6, 2016. The title of this lecture is Financial Statement Analysis.
Tonight, Financial Statement Analysis. This is the first of two lectures that have to do with financial statements. In this one, I'm going to do more of a light overview, show you where you can get financial statements, and show you some of the highlights and some of the tricks and traps in looking at financial statements. I am hopeful that there will be some of this that will be useful to you in other courses. Because one thing that I have found out over the years I've been teaching here is that different professors, especially when you get into your junior and senior year, they are having you do projects where you're going to need to get financial information. Sometimes they ask for things that you can tell that they're not finance people that, or accounting folks, and they'll ask for something that is really not the right term for what they're looking for. But there are also situations where a term that is very commonly used in a financial statement might not be in the financial statements that you're looking for. But there is a big payoff to what I'm going to do here in terms of how easy it is to get information. Start out with a story from the Dark Ages. A company goes public by registering some kind of security with the Securities and Exchange Commission. For the purpose of simplicity, although this is not, there are a lot of different things that you could do. A company can sell common stock. Now understand that you can privately place common stock, sell it to very sophisticated investors, and you have to do pretty much nothing because you're invoking an exemption from registration. But if you want to sell stock publicly, you become a public corporation, that stock can be freely tradable, but you must register the stock with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Seriously, do I even have a... I do have a marker. Okay, I'm going to show you, bring up two broad ways. One is through a public offering of common stock. You must register this with the Securities and Exchange Commission. You also, any state in which you would sell this stock, you're probably going to have to register it with the state securities regulators as well. Now, the big 800-pound gorilla for selling stock in a public offering to go public would be the Form S-1. This is a monster document. Back in my time, I actually did one full-blown Form S-1 successfully, it was. There's a first part that is all of the structured information the SEC wants. Then there's a second part, which is the selling document itself that you propose to hand to investors to get them to buy. That's called the prospectus. And then there's the third part, the butt end of it, which is your audited financial statements. Now, there are variations on this. There's a Form SB1, smaller offerings, and then there's an SB2, and there are other forms. But this is the classic way that you register securities that you are going to sell with the Securities and Exchange Commission. I did one of these in my time. Now you can't do it unless you're a bunch of lawyers and accountants all working together. They've tightened it up so much that these small-time cats like I was back in the 80s and 90s, I mean, they'd probably throw me in prison for even trying to do it now, or even talking about doing it, or even consulting on it these days. But back in the day, that thing was way too much like work. When you you fill out these forms, and this is where I want to get to the paperwork. Back in the day, these were paper forms, and it was a monstrous document with all these different parts to it. And I filed it on behalf of the company as their consultant, and the SEC came back with their deficiencies list. By fax, here came the deficiencies. I almost ran out of fax paper. 487 deficiencies. I called up an old consultant who was a lawyer, and I told him what had just happened. He said, well, that's not bad for your first one. So I filed it again, fixed the deficiencies, spent 2 days, and I came back with 6 deficiencies. Not bad. Third time, the SEC came back. Now, a government agency never, for anything that you do, approves of what you've done. The term is qualifies it. So I got back on the third pass, the SEC qualified the offering. And then you go into the quiet period where you don't talk about it, you don't announce it, you don't say anything about it to outside investors. You got your prospectus, you get those printed up. The first time you print them up, you get red lettering across the top. In other words, this is not the real selling document. This is what will be once the SEC says go. That's called a red herring. And I'll kind of bring this back up later again. Okay, that is what we did, these massive filings. They were huge paper filings. There's another way that a company can go public, though. It's on Form 10. Form 10 can be filed if you already have stock that you have sold in private placements. Now, in private placements, that stock is not registered. That stock cannot be sold by those investors. It is subject to hard rule 144. You can't sell that stock. So, in other words, you've got private investors, angel investors. And what you've done is you've sold them money to start your business, okay? Now, later, those angel investors or those other investors are going to say, all right, we want to be able to sell our stock. We want to make money off our investment. And that means that you have to register that stock with the Securities and Exchange Commission. So Form 10 would be to register securities that have already been sold in private placements. And I'll tell you some of the exemptions and how they work. You can't just say, well, I'm in a private placement, I'll sell. No, you can't do that. You have to sell it to investors that have meet certain qualifications and all that. Now, interestingly enough, there are times when a Form S-1 can do both. You're registering new stock that I'm going to sell stock to a bunch of normal investors. I register that. But I have a couple of private investors who bought stock earlier, and I can register your stock piggyback on the public registration of the new issue that I'm going to do. So you got all kinds of twisted variations. Keep in mind, though, that those are big paperwork forms. And once you have done that, you are... Are you married? Okay. There will be a time when you're married. Okay. You will no longer be able to wander out, at 12 o'clock to get White Castles. You won't be able to just, I feel like going on a vacation for 3 days. No, because someone's going to be calling you, honey, where are you? I'm like over in Los Angeles. I didn't remember that I'm married. Okay, once you are married, you can't do those kinds of things anymore. You are in the program. You report on a regular basis everything that is meaningful and material about your company. Essentially, whichever way you went public, Form S-1 or one of those ways, or Form 10, you then forever file periodic amendments to your original filings. They're literally like amendments. Every year, you will file Form 10-K, which is a baby version of your registration statement with new information, new financials, new plans, new goals, and all that. This is a monster document. I made money doing these for companies back in the day. And then every quarter, you will be filing Form 10-Q. We call these the Qs and Ks. You will do that for the rest of eternity as a public company. I had companies that actually managed to go public. They played a trick. They did a reverse merger. A private company would reverse merge into a dead public company. And then, well, we're a public company now. Isn't this cool? We got a trading symbol and all that. And then they find out, oh my God, every quarter you have to file this monster document. And then every year you have to file this super monster document. Well, that kind of sucks. Well, welcome to the being a public company. Your responsibility. And there are other forms that you'll have to follow too along the way, file along the way. Oh, here's one that I made a decent amount of money on, Form 8K. This is a report for non-recurring events. If anything happens, see, Q's and K's are recurring every quarter, every year. An 8K is when something happens that is not in the normal recurring sense. It would be, you're the president of this public corporation, and last night you were sucked into an alien mothership. They were aiming at some cows, but they got you into it too. Now that is material to the company, so they're going to call me. Your vice president is going to call me. What do we do? I said, well, first thing we do is file an 8K. Okay. Well, shouldn't we see if we can find him? Well, yeah, but later. But first the 8K. I mean, let's get our priorities straight. You know. I made a lot of money. And quite honestly, back in the 80s, there were all these companies. They had, to a greater or lesser extent, there was something legit there. But they would try to pump and dump on their stock. They would try to do press releases to get investors to buy the stock, boost that, would bring the price of the stock up, and then the insiders could sell some of their stock to make a little money. Okay? Pump and dump. And so every time they did one of those press releases, an 8K had to be filed. Well, I was more than happy to do that, you know, $50 a shot. That also, finally, after a while, they got sick of doing that. And so they stopped doing these, you know, just a press release for nonsense, for no reason whatsoever, which was most of what they were. And but that was something that I could do to make a little money. And then a few of the companies stopped telling me that they had done a press release, and I wasn't paying attention to the news wires. And sure enough, the SEC would eventually come up and nail them to the wall for failure to do the filing. And of course, they'd say, well, he did it, our consultant. He was supposed to file an 8K. Anyway. Okay, these were all paper documents. They were like books. They were ridiculous. It was just like a project. Every company that was public had to do these. Every quarter, every year, it was like a crisis. It still is. But then in the 1980s, there was an internet back then, believe it or not. It wasn't called the internet, the World Wide Web. But electronic filings began to be experimented with by the SEC. And I was one of the first that piloted a program where instead of a paper document you could file, you could file it electronically. Now, if you know anything about how web pages work, well, not anymore, but they used to work like, for example, if you want something to be bold, you use these HTML markup tags, bold, high, slash, and bold. Those are HTML markup tags, okay? They were the origins, they were the first way that web pages were made so that they were visually appealing back in the 90s. Before that, though, there was a much more generalized markup language. In fact, it was called SGML, Standard Generalized Markup Language. With that, you could create tags around words like title, form 10K. / end title. And if you knew how to do this, you could build an entire form 10K, 10Q, 8K, and then send it through this to this electronic system the SEC was playing with called, not playing with, they were piloting called EDGAR, E-D-G-A-R. I mean, it was a real pain in the butt at first, but once you had the tag set built up, you could just fly through and create these a lot faster than in the old days. Headers for each section of it. There was SGML tags for all this stuff. But once you had the setup ready, you could just fly through it. And so began the era of the Edgar filing system. And now, I think it is prohibited to file paper unless there's some extenuating circumstance. I'm not sure about that, though. But all public companies, pretty much all, do these Edgar filings now. They file with the Edgar system. Interestingly enough, I made decent money just doing this for companies in the early days of Edgar. And then it began, the big dogs started stepping into it, and then eventually there were rules and laws passed and people like me couldn't do it anymore, even though I was one of the original pilot users of the system. But there you go. But here you go. Let me show you. And some of you were shown this in Business 100. Some of you weren't, but there's a payoff to what I'm going to show you here. Is the Edgar filing system. Filings. Edgar. Oh, there. Search for company filings. Okay. Just sec.gov, go to filings. Okay. Seriously? I think I got myself off track there. Let me do this. Edgar. Okay. Yeah, I definitely got myself somehow. Okay. Now, no, I don't want to call the SEC's attention to me. Okay, fast search. You got the trading symbol, watch it. If you type in a company name, you might get a whole lot of companies and you don't know which one is which. It amazes you how many companies have the same name and you've got to figure out which one of them is the one you want. But if you've got the trading symbol, well, that's another thing entirely. NFLX, I'll use. And here we have the filings, the most recent first. Now, you can narrow it down, type 10-K, 10-Q, whatever. But I want to show you the whole nine yards. They have just done a quarterly filing recently. That's their most recent filing. Hey, see a couple of 8Ks there? Non-recurring, something that's a non-recurring event. I don't know what it is. But then you got all these that have, a lot of them have to do with things like insiders who sell some stock. You're allowed to sell some stock as an insider, but you got to do it at certain times. You know, you've not made some important announcement. You're not about to make an important announcement. And you can't do too much. You have these windows in which you can sell your restricted stock if you're an insider. Some of these are that. There's our last 10K. Okay? Right there. Now, here's a very extremely cool part that's useful for you, for projects that you might engage in down the road here or in a business that you would work for. The interactive. You can actually download an Excel sheet. Any public company, you can bring down all of its financial statements. Look at this. Every financial statement, income statements, statements of balance sheets, currency stuff. Look at this. And then you can do whatever you want with them. Make charts, make reports, use it for your purposes in your classes. Any public company has to do this and provide these available to anyone who wants to use their financial information. So as I said, you need to make a report on a company or something like that. Well, hell, this is one of the fastest ways you can do it. And this is original stuff. The SEC, the thing is, that there are companies that will try to lie to the SEC. It's just a reality. But the cost of that could be, if you lie to the SEC, that is the best way in the world for you to become some hard-timer's old lady at a federal facility. Okay? Now, we were talking about angel investors earlier, you and I were. Okay, lie to the SEC, you can go to prison. Lie to some of these investors, private investors, like Russians, and you will wish that you had gone to a federal prison. Okay, so lying is something that you probably don't want to do either to private or public resources. The SEC is probably the closest you will get to honest, straight-up information anywhere about a company. Trust me on this. I know that there are companies that will try to mislead, but quite honestly, I'm going to show you something else here real quick. I'm going to take this down. You don't have to look at these, but let me take you back one step here. If you don't want to use the interactives, you can actually go to the monster document itself. These are all the different parts of it. Again, they were filed with SGML tags all around them and all kinds of stuff. This is the core, the beast. This used to be on paper. This is what a 10K looks like. And let me go down through just for a minute. This shouldn't take long. No, not long at all. And on, and on, and on, and on, and on, and on, and on. You see what I mean? This is a beast of a document. But there's something useful about this one even. I'm going to try to find it here if I can. It's called the Management Discussion and Analysis, the MD&A, item 7. When a company puts together its 10Ks and its 10Qs, it has incentive to be as honest and as glib and as straightforward as possible. If you read this, you learn a whole lot about a company. They're very glib, they use numbers, and they don't pull punches in this analysis. The management discussion and analysis can be a very good resource for seeing what the company's actual top dogs are thinking about their company. And it's right there in the MD&A, the Management Discussion and Analysis. They're very straightforward. They're honest with you about what's going on with their company. And that's in the Form 10K. Now let me pull myself back here, and I'm going to go back to the interactive. Now, the interactive thing, that's your financials. And we can download it or we can just look at it, financial statements here. Okay, this consolidated, this is where we get into terminology. The first one we'll look at is what in this one is called consolidated financial statements of operations. That is a fancy way of saying, oh, there's a summary income statement. 3 years of it. The summary income statement. Some companies will call it the income statement. Some companies will call it the consolidated statement of operations. Some companies call it profit and loss statement. It can have different names. Know that. And then within these, there's a lot of variation for the same thing. See this one? This one is called revenues. In some financial income statements, it would be called something else. Madam, what do you suppose would be another name for revenues?
Profit.
No. Sales. Sales. It can be called sales. You think, well, is there a rule for which one it's called? No. I've seen it called sales. I've seen it called revenue. Now, the next one here is called cost of revenues. I would bet in your accounting classes, did they call it cost of goods sold, COGS? Same thing. It's the cost that can be directly associated with the product. Think of it like the wholesale cost. In my business, if I create a work of art, there is a frame, this museum glass, this backing called the dry mount, then these mats, put that all together, and I sell that as a unit. Those parts I can directly associate with the sale price. So that would be cost of goods sold. But there are other things, like, for example, printing inks, paper, because I can run 3 or 4 or 5 prints before I get one that's acceptable. I mean, there are the costs of the lights. There's the cost of my equipment. There's the cost of the medicines to fix myself back up after I've fallen into a barbed wire fence and all that, doing my photography. So there are some costs that you can't associate with the product. And then there are some costs that you can associate with the product. Now, here's the interesting thing. Back in the day, there would have been a line right under cost of goods sold. You would have your sales minus your cost of goods sold. And then there would have been this one minus this one. That would have been called gross income or gross profit. It's the amount of money that survived wholesale. Okay? In this case, with Netflix, you see, it's not there. I almost automatically anymore, I'll just put in insert line and use the Excel insert a row, and I do that calculation because it's useful to know how much money after you've paid for your goods and service, your goods, how much is left to pay the rest of your bills. Okay, but it's not here. Almost never do you see this. Companies don't have to do it. Apparently, it's just sort of a fad to not report that one line. But it's worth knowing it anyway. Now, also an interesting thing is, if you take, and we'll do this on Thursday more technically. I'll hit you with more technical on Thursday. Here we're just taking the tour. Gross income divided by sales. That is what we call your gross margin. In other words, how many cents of each dollar survive wholesale. If I were to look at Netflix here, if I were to take, what is that? That's about 2.2 billion divided by 6.7 billion. That's about one third. So in other words, about 30, I don't know, I should do the calculation just real quick here. Okay. Seriously? Just let me do the calculation here. It would be 4.591 divided by 6.780, and then minus 1. Only about 32 cents of every dollar that they took in survived the cost of bringing that product in. Now, is that bad or is that good? You'd have to look at the industry. Honestly, you'd have to say, all right, what's normal? In some businesses, your gross margin can be like 90 cents of every dollar survives wholesale. In other businesses, it's like 10 cents of every dollar survives wholesale. In this Netflix, about 32 cents of every dollar that they make survives the cost of getting that product to sell. I don't know. It's hard to say, though. I'd have to look at Hulu and other ones to see, honestly. But that's a little bit scary when you think that they're paying that much of every dollar to make the dollar. But anyway, just moving on down, the rest of these are these general expenses that can't be associated with a specific product. Like, for example, notice that it looks like about 12% of Netflix's sales, they are spending on marketing. Whatever. Okay, now, down here, the next place you're going to run into one that is that has a couple of different terms for it, operating income. That is your gross income minus these expenses. The other term for operating income, and you'll hear me use it, you'll hear finance people use it quite a bit, is EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. EBIT. It's the same as operating income. And And it is literally how much money remains to pay your interest and to pay your taxes. Now, here we have an interest expense of $132,716,000. The money available to pay that is the $305,625,000. Okay, now, straight up question, just a quick question. Okay. Ma'am, if that interest expense was bigger than the operating income, what would you know about the company? Say it. Not exactly at a loss. They are dead. They are ended. The debt holders were not satisfied, and they have the prior claim. So this, the debt holders in this company, remember why I said debt holders will do to you if you don't pay them? Now, the shareholders, you don't have to give them a dividend. All they can do is cry and fuss. But if you don't pay the debt holders, they will take you out to a field, make you dig your grave, and then they'll shoot you, and you'll fall into it. And then they'll cover you over and go back and take all your stuff that you had. Except for those Elvis paintings. They are not going to want those. I know they're velvet. They were meaningful to you. They have no liquidation value. Okay, you see it? So in other words, we get really interested. We're very excited about having that operating income line bigger than the interest expense line under it. It has to be enough to cover that interest expense, or they are in default and the debt holders just swoop right in and that's the end of it. The company can try to go to a bankruptcy court and get protection from them, but it just gets ugly from there. In the case of Netflix, they have their interest, they have plenty of money to pay it. Although, interestingly enough, you notice that they're, do you see how their interest expense, especially as a percent of money available to pay the interest expense, has been going up and up and up? Do you see that? Look, it went from about less than 30 mil up to about 50 mil, and now it's at 132 mil. Even though the revenue, actually the revenue skidded rather nastily there. They had, and then we're going to go through this next time, but then we have to ask ourselves, all right, what in the heck happened here? Do you see how they had these expenses just leap on them? You see it? Marketing took a pretty decent jump. Their technology and development took a darn good jump. And their SG&A, that would be like salaries, wages, stuff like that, a little catch-all category, really jumped too. So their net income, so their operating income for the last year of reporting, 2015, at the end of 2015, at the end of last year, that they actually, okay, let me take it this way. Remember I told you Netflix just borrowed a pile of money last year? There it is. See it? That's the interest expense. The question is, are they using that money to make money? Yeah, they've got their interest expense has really jumped. They borrowed a pile of money. The technical term for it is they borrowed a buttload of money. And now the question is, are they turning that money that they borrowed into revenue and profit? And it doesn't look like it's going so well for them yet. But we'll see. Okay, interest expense, and then we got our taxes. Here we go. Net income. That's a fancy word for profit. That is how much is left for the shareholders. That number right there belongs to the shareholders. The residual claim above this, debt holders were being satisfied in a timely fashion. Debt holders with long-term debt, debt holders who were billing them for services, debt holders who were their workers, who got paychecks, all of those people got taken care of. The debt holders have the prior claim. At the bottom line there, that net income, That belongs to the shareholders. You can give them dividends, or you can put that money back into the company to earn more money. Period. One way or the other, you can do it. Now, the earnings per share, that would be taking the total earnings divided by the number of shares outstanding. See this one, basic and then diluted? Diluted, basic is how many shares are right now out there trading in the market, existing. Diluted adds in the shares that haven't been born yet. They are in options, usually for the executives or something like that. And so they're not out there yet, but it's like, okay, if all of those suddenly came to life, were born, that would be the diluted. In this case, you notice it's really not much of a difference. Although I have to say, that's a little bit of a dent there. Okay. And this is the weighted average number of shares outstanding, 425 million. Oh, yeah, look at that. They've got about 11 million shares, a little less than 11 million shares, that are sitting in options, probably executives. That bothers me a little bit, but, you know, whatever. Now, this one, I want you to look at something here. This is a little side stream, and a lot of people ignore these. And this is, if you want to do real financial analysis, either as a person who does this for a living or for your own benefit, for your own investments, or just for your own curiosity, these little statements have something to say. Foreign currency translation adjustments. 2013, 1,772,000. 2014, 7 million. By the end of 2015, almost $38 million. From a positive $1.7 million, 2 years later, a negative $37 million. What's that mean? What's that all about? It's not hugely significant, but it's worth having a look at. Anyone want to just take a stab at it? Great. I just poured coffee all over myself. Got a guess? I know, it's tough at first. This is the effect of internationalization. They're reaching into international markets, and the currency translations, if I charge dollars and the currency goes against me, then I might lose on the translation. So this is one of those things that you kind of have to keep an eye out for, is that sometimes you'll see that globalization, internationalization, and all that kind of stuff can have its negative side. That's why some companies, not all companies, but some companies use hedge funds so that they take opposite positions. So if a currency turns ugly on them where they're doing business, they lose on the currency, but they make money on the futures contract. And vice versa, conversely, if they make money on the currency conversion, they lose money on the futures contract. That way, they have no risk exposure with the currency itself. That keeps them from getting into the business of currency instead of what their core business model has them doing. Anyway, enough of that. Consolidated statement. Yeah, that's not too interesting, but this one is. Okay, this is your statement of cash flows. This is more interesting to a financial person because this adds back in things that are taken out. A lot of things that are taken out, like depreciation, that's not a real expense. This adds it back in. Buying a building or building something, that's money out of your pocket, but that doesn't show up as a full blast in your income statements. This takes that out. You want to know, this shows what actually happened to the real cash of a company. Tell you a story here. This happened about five years ago. The finance club has these ISU alum who are now out there. They're getting into good positions in good companies and all of that. And we had this dinner and banquet, and then we had this discussion panel where we had these alum talk to the current students, finance students, and tell them what it's like out there in the real world. And then there was this question and answer period. We had a couple of the alum that we had at that dinner were from Caterpillar. And this one lady, she's a graduate of ISU from some years back, and she was quite glib when she was saying that it was only in the past year that the word came down from on high, a caterpillar, knock it off with all this obsession with profit. Quit it. We have got to focus on cash flow, not on profit. Now, this was 4 years ago. Caterpillar was just then beginning to understand profit doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter at all. What matters is your cash flow. Caterpillar, it took them a couple of years to turn it, I guess, the way she talked, it was going to take time for them to turn the thinking of the company away from this idea that that bottom line profit on an income statement is what the life and death of a company is all about. Tell you another story from an executive of a decent-sized company right here in town. She was telling about how they had gotten in a $6 million check for something or other, some service. And she said before she knew what had happened, some of her subordinates had paid bills with that $6 million. Paid off maybe about, $4.5 million in bills. She had a cow at them. You don't pay your bills until they're due. Most of those bills were due for a month, 2 months, 3 months out there. There was that $6 million they could have been using, but they paid bills with it. Oh, my God. You pay the bills when they're due, not when, we got the money, so we better pay that now. It's cash flow. It's cash flow that is king. That particular lady, just a bright, bright woman, just she is quite famous in her company for the fact that she manages cash flow so well. It has made her division so daggone laden with money just because she knows how to manage the cash flow, not worrying about profit. A great example of this. There are some gas stations, chains of gas stations, that are still doing this to this day. Some states have outlawed it, but a lot of states haven't. You go to some gas stations, you put in your debit card or your credit card, and what it will do is it will lock in $100, $150. Just lock it up for 3, 4, 5 days. Now, you get $35, $40 worth of gas. What they'll do is they will unlock, take their claim off that money after 4 or 5 days, the difference. But there for those days, they've got your money under their control. Now, you imagine that they've got 100,000, half a million customers. At any given time, they have locked away $50 that isn't theirs. And as money flows out back into accounts, more suckers are coming to their pumps and putting their debit cards or their credit cards in. Cash flow. These companies, at any given time, the visual look of their balance sheets, but especially their cash flow position, is ridiculous compared to the size of the company itself. Have any of you ever noticed a gas company locking in? Most people don't even know that that's happening. It's just that they're locking up some money of yours for a few days and then releasing it back to you. Yeah, I've got $50 worth of gas, but they locked away $100. So they essentially will give you back the $50 that they locked up, but not right away, not at the time you put the pump back on. Cash flow is king. Cash flow is everything in finance. So anyway, I beefed at you enough about that. The rest of this, I'm sure you saw it in accounting and all that. We'll talk about more down the road, but there's one other thing I want to show. Oh, balance sheet. Strangely enough, now sometimes I'm not sure as I'm getting older of what actually happened, but I am sure that back in the old days, you did 5 years of income statements, 5 years of balance sheets. Now the standard, and I haven't done this in a long time myself personally, But it looks like the standard is 3 years of income statements and only 2 years of balance sheets. I mean, that makes it pretty hard to do trend analysis. 3 years isn't really good. I'd rather have 5 years. And interestingly enough, if you dig around in the Edgar filing statements and in these Excel sheets, you will find more years. But in the summaries, 2 years for the balance sheets. I want to bring this up, though, okay? Now, Madam, you've had your accounting course here, have you not? Okay. Most of you, it surprised me, you're actually fairly normal after you've made it through your accounting. It's supposed to sort of damage your psyche and all that, but you make it through. And you remember along the way, the retained earnings. Story from many years ago. Retained earnings doesn't exist except on the accounting statement. Retained earnings is supposed to be a part of the measure of stockholder value, how much the stockholder's value is in the company. Retained earnings. The story goes that executives, large number of executives, junior executives, were talking about financing a project, and one of the junior executives said, well, why don't we just finance it out of retained earnings? One of the old executives said, son, I want you to leave and go find the checkbook that says retained earnings. If you find it, you bring it back here and we'll write a check and you can come back to the meetings. But until you find a checkbook that says retained earnings, you're not allowed in these meetings anymore. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing as retained earnings. It is a story. Doesn't exist in any way, shape, or form. However, in the interest of refreshing your memory, you remember that retained earnings at the beginning plus net income for the period minus dividends paid out is your retained earnings at the end of the period. It supposedly measures how much new money is in the company that belongs to the shareholders. Now, there's another part to this. It's your capital stock. How much money you got for selling your stock, $10, let's say $10 a share for 1 million shares. Okay, so what we might have here is $10 million in capital stock. Your retained earnings at the beginning were $2 million. $400 million. And then your net income for the period was $100 million. You paid out dividends of $20 million. So your retained earnings at the end were $480 million. And then you add that and that together, 10. Is there some reason this sucks? Oh, yeah. And this is your total shareholders' equity. How much there was from capital stock sales plus your net of how much you had built up in retained earnings, adding the income for the period minus your dividends for the period, and that would be $10,480,000, something like that. I so suck at accounting. Okay. Here's a problem. That has no meaning. It's supposed to represent your total value of the shareholders' equity. See it right here for Netflix? 2.223. $2,223,000,000. Okay, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you over here, finance.yahoo.com, and then we're going to use Netflix, NFLX. NFLX. The market cap is the market's valuation of the shareholders' total shareholders' equity. The market's determination of the total value of the shareholder equity is $42.91 billion. The financial statements, the accounting, says that it's $2.223 billion. Again, the market says that the total shareholder equity, the number of shares outstanding times the price per share, is 42.91, just shy of 43 billion. The financial statements say the book value, you'll hear me use the term book, book on the equity is $2.2 billion. You'll hear these financial, well, the market value is well above the book value. The market cap is well above the book value, so that means that this is an overvalued stock. It means nothing of the kind. It means nothing. The book value has no meaning whatsoever. Unless the market value is well below the book value, then I have that kind of gets me a little bit interested. But other than that situation, the book value is just an account. That doesn't mean the accountants are lying or anything like that. They have to do it by generally accepted accounting principles. The market is the organic animal that decides. Now, think about it. See, find someone who won't be offended by that. Okay, you, sir. Okay? I'm your mom, okay? Now, I think you're the greatest young man in the world. You're so sweet, you're so handsome, you're so beautiful. Oh my goodness, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Okay. The market, let's say Twitter, thinks you suck. You are ugly. You are so ugly you could knock a bulldog off a meat wagon. Ugly. And you're also mean and nasty and hateful. Okay? Now, which opinion is going to get you social acceptance?
Probably my Twitter.
Yeah, yeah. You see, the accounting statements are mom. The market cap is the world. And it's the world that's going to determine what you are worth. Not what mom thinks of you, not what dad thinks of you, not what your Aunt Mabel thinks of you. It will be the world that determines you. That's why when they say book value, I don't worry too much about it. But again, you know, if I saw the market had a lower opinion of this company than the book, it'd probably be pretty obvious this company was in severe trouble. But typically speaking, normally, I mean, you know, what can I say? I'll show you another one here real quick. Let me pull up another one. Okay. Let me try Apple. What do you mean no filing? What's app? What did I write there? Let me try Google. 10K. Where's anyone see the 10K? Am I going to miss it? 10Q, 10Q. I want to get back to a 10K. Oh, there we go. Okay. Financial statements, statement of operations, parenthetical balance sheets. Okay. Book for Google. Good grief. Book for Google, $120 billion. Okay, that's book for Google. Now, GOOG. $536 billion. Do you see the difference? The book really doesn't mean a whole lot here. It's just a number. It's just a record-keeping device. Okay, now, enough of that. Let me take you really quick, just for the rest of this, is that these consolidated financial statements, statements of cash flow, they'll have slightly different names. And remember again that the internal numbers themselves, the names might be different. But overall, you know, this is just, it's not that hard for you to go to these and get all the information you want. And in the next lecture, I'm going to take you through and we're going to break down some of these and look for the interesting numbers that they can show to us. Always recognizing this is accounting data. Okay? Now, I'm going to give you a quiz here, and then that is all I have for you tonight. I thank you.